Hello, it's Tuesday, January the 26th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show, coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up... Have you been having strange calls from HMRC saying you owe lots of money and you've got to pay it straight away? If so, it's almost certainly a con. Is your dog at risk of being stolen? Look out, because in lockdown, a lot more pooches have gone missing. A new survey in the Daily Mail shows, guess what? That poorest children are hardest hit by the lockdown. All the more reason, Secretary of State for Education Gavin Williamson, get the schools open. But first, the EU has threatened to ride roughshod over an agreement between the United Kingdom and Pfizer for the distribution of the vaccine. And you know why? Because the EU's vaccination process is in a state of total chaos. The EU has threatened to impose strict controls on the export of coronavirus vaccines made within the bloc to what are called third countries. In other words, Great Britain. Conservative MPs have warned that the move will poison relations between the EU and Britain for a generation if it follows through on threats which could block the Pfizer vaccine made in Belgium from coming to the United Kingdom, even though the government has signed a major legally binding contract with Pfizer. Joining me to discuss this is Sir Ian Duncan-Smith, the Conservative MP and former leader of the Conservative Party. Sir Ian, you and I have talked about the EU many times. This strikes me as the EU floundering because their own procurement policy for the vaccine is in big trouble and they're lashing out.
Yes, I think you may be right, Andrew. I think, number one, I'm not sure this is lawful. And I'd be a real test for the European Court of Justice if this is referred to them by the companies as to whether or not this is really lawful. This is a commercial contract, number one. Second thing is that I think, if anything, it demonstrates one of the big reasons why the UK voted to leave, is because this kind of arbitrary process done on no other basis other than selfishness is kind of how the EU works. Contrast this with the UK's position on vaccines, particularly on the AstraZeneca Oxford one, where we have been offering this to the whole third world. We have generously said we will work to make sure this is available as soon as possible to the third world once it's in full production, and to find ways to license it, etc. Compare that to the EU, which says, no, we don't want to send it to you. You've left the EU and we're going to hold on to this because we're in a mess and we're going to blame everybody else for the mess that we're in. This is mean-spirited, selfish, self-centered, and I think utterly, utterly arrogant for them to think that they are standalone superior to everybody else. What a shocker.
They're also arguing, aren't they, that they say AstraZeneca are not going to carry out or deliver as many doses of the vaccine as they'd anticipated. But the argument about that seems to be rather academic, sir, bearing in mind the EU regulator has still not approved the AstraZeneca vaccine for use, and it's been going into people's arms in this country now 4 weeks, and we've given out now more than 6 million vaccines.
Agreed, and this is the other bizarre thing, that their process is so bureaucratic that they can't accelerate it. Now, here's the difference. Our system is such that they've been able to speed it up, not by skipping bits, but by running them in what they call parallel. So all the various tests that have taken place, they normally would wait till one is complete before starting the next part, instead of which they've done them all in parallel, which means they all reach a climax at the same time, and thus they were able in the authority here in the UK to give it approval. In Europe, they've done nothing to speed up their processes, and that shows you how hidebound and bureaucratic they are. But, you know, at the end of it all, we are friends and allies, and we've made this statement already, the government, Boris Johnson, about the third world, how we owe an obligation to help them as well. But you don't get any of that from the European Union. What you get is a rather grasping process that wants to blame everybody else for having failed to get this right. And the AstraZeneca vaccine has been signed off by our teams. And if there's some problem they've got with it, then why are they trying to blame them for not supplying them when they haven't even signed it off? There's no logic to their position. It's a mean-spirited and wholly unworthy position that they've taken.
You will recall, too, when the decision was taken, I don't know if it was in June or July, Alok Sharma, who was the then business secretary, took the decision to withdraw Britain from the EU procurement policy for the vaccine. There was a huge row at the time. The Labour Party, very critical, accusing the Tory government of Little England policy. It's all about Brexit and versus Remain. But actually, that decision has been paid dividends because we are, I think, the third most advanced country in the world after the UAE and Israel in the delivery of the vaccine.
And notice those are small entities, countries. And there's the point. The reason we withdrew was because the bureaucratic process that required huge amount of common purpose between the whole of the EU has proven itself to be slow and very, very leaden-footed. UK left the EU because we want to be quick. We want to be able to make decisions that are based around what's good for the UK and our friends and allies, not what is run by somebody else. And so to this degree, this demonstrates what Brexit was about. It's not a mean-spirited thing. It was all about the UK wanting to get stuff done quickly, wanting to be able to make decisions about its regulations, to set them for what's best for the UK, not what may be best for another part of Europe. And that is a good proof as to why we left. It wasn't about being against Europe. It was about saying we want to be able to be faster, quicker, and more centered around what's good for us. But the one thing that I add to that, though, Andrew, is an important thing. We have not forgotten the third world. The first thing the British government did was to say we will do our level best to help the third world to get these vaccines. We want to be able to help others. That very contrasts very badly with the European Union's attitude.
If I could ask you just finally, Sirian, if the European Union does carry out its threat to restrict the supply of the Pfizer vaccine made in Brussels to third countries, in other words, Great Britain, despite the fact we've signed this huge contract with Pfizer, what should be the response of the British government?
Well, the first thing is we should encourage Pfizer to go to the courts about this straight away for an immediate judgment, because I think that they're acting beyond their powers. And the second thing is to respond by saying, we're not going to respond. What we're going to do is carry on. We're going to do our best, and you do your worst, and you see who the rest of the world thinks is decent, honorable, and we will still get our people vaccinated faster than you will and more effectively. So you do your worst, but we're going to do our best for the British people.
Fighting talk from Sirian Duncan-Smith, the Conservative MP. Thanks for joining us. So it's hardly a surprise, but the devastating way that pupils' attainment levels and ability to study have plummeted because of school closures is laid bare today. One in three parents say their children's sense of education fulfilment has been damaged, with a guess what? The poorest kids worst affected. This is all according to a JL Partners poll for today's Daily Mail. Joining me now is Chris McGovern, who is chairman of the Campaign for Real Education and no stranger to this podcast. Mr. McGovern, it's obvious, isn't it? If kids don't go to school, despite the best efforts of some teachers to teach them online, it's not the same. It's going to badly impact their chances and their learning abilities.
That's true, it is. And what's more worrying is that some children suffer more than others. Middle class children who are at good schools providing good online material suffer much less than many children, many millions of children who are in poorer environment, don't have ready access to a laptop, and don't have much parental support, perhaps. You know, I work with these children, and what's always quite a shock, I think, to people is that we talk about giving support to children, or the parents giving support to children. When we find out that some of these parents themselves are illiterate and innumerate, you realize there is a problem, and some parents have spend their time trying to put food on the table. Some of them are involved in crime. Some of them are involved in drugs. There's a lot of pressure on a lot of children. And for those children from poorer backgrounds, only the school provides a refuge and a safe place in their lives. So when we talk about online provision, we have to bear in mind that the online provision varies a lot. Some of it's quite good. Some schools are doing 3 or 4 hours a day. Some are doing half an hour a day. And the quality of that provision is very varied. So some children are suffering very greatly and may never recover from what's going on.
And I'm glad you've mentioned the parents, Chris McGovern, because, of course, we know that some children will have very poor broadband. You've already mentioned that some children won't have very good iPads or computers. As you know, the Daily Mail is running a campaign to get lots of iPads into children's hands that have been upgraded for school use. But actually, there will be some parents who simply aren't interested in their children's education. They may have to go to work, they may be distracted, as you say, they may have drug-related issues too, and those are the children that seem to fall between two stools.
Yeah, that's right. And look, the school I took over, which was a failing school with severe problems, the first thing we had to do was to feed the children, so you know, the children coming from backgrounds where they weren't even getting fed. And then if the parents did turn up at all, sometimes they turned up in a dressing gown, they were fighting, they were swearing, they were on drugs. There were real issues. Now, the children themselves are fine. You know, you have to remember that when we're dealing with children, whether they're from a good background or a supportive background or from a poor background, they all want to succeed. And it's desperately sad. And congratulations to the Mail, because they're doing something to help. But we've got to think about the long-term consequences. Not only the children themselves, but all of us will suffer if we have a lot of young people growing up who have no prospects, no chance of a job, and they're unemployable, and they're going to be joining gangs and so forth. There's going to be severe social consequences to that. So when we talk about helping children from underprivileged backgrounds, it is a serious problem which affects all of us, even though in the short term it may only affect the children. But at the moment, the price we are paying for closing the schools in the short term may be worth paying, but in the long term, I suspect it will not be worth paying, because we've got severe problems in our country. It is a country where already we are running up to 3 years behind the educational standards in the best countries around the world in terms of education. So we're talking about Singapore, we're talking about parts of China, Japan, Taiwan, and even closer to home in Europe, Poland and Estonia are a long way ahead of the British. So we've got real problems in this country, and it's going to get worse if these children at the bottom of the pile are allowed to fall further and further behind. And look, many of these children are going to be children in the future who, if properly educated, could make a great contribution to this country.
Now, look, you've been involved in education, Chris McGovern, for decades. It's a difficult question. I want to ask you this, but which group of children is it most important we get back to school first? And there is a report out today suggesting that we may be able to get primary school children back, reports suggesting that A, they're less, the children are less infectious with COVID. And we also know the Office of National Statistics said this week that teachers are not a high-risk group. They've not been adversely impacted by COVID. So do we need to get those primary school children back first, or doesn't it matter which age group? They're all as important.
When I was a head teacher, I was a head teacher actually in a primary school, though I taught a lot of my career in large comprehensive secondary schools. But when I was talking to incoming parents, and I was head of a school which had 7 applicants for each place, so presumably people thought I was doing a decent job, the first thing I said to parents, you have to understand the most important year in a child's life as far as school is concerned is the first year. Need to stop worrying quite so much about the A-levels and the GCSEs. Year one is the most important. That's when the foundations are put down. So in terms of what's most important, primary schools, but also in terms of safety, we know that children who are young are much less likely to be damaged by the virus. But, you know, children are more likely to be hit by lightning than damaged by the virus. So young children in particular, they're more important. We need to get away from this obsession with GCSEs and A-levels. It's the young children, most of all, who need support. And, the priority has to be young children. Teachers, there's an issue here because teachers, we have the youngest teaching force in Europe, therefore less likely to be damaged by the virus, but they are worried. And therefore, I think we need to vaccinate the teachers simply to restore confidence amongst the teaching profession. There are some fantastic teachers out there battling on, doing a great job, but there's also some, as we're talking now, who will be earning money during the lockdown by offering private tutoring, which is something the Mail has actually highlighted. So there are some bad apples in the barrel, but essentially get the primary school children back and get them back now, for heaven's sake. They're not going to cause problems. And people like myself of an older generation don't wish to be protected. We want our grandchildren to have the priority, not ourselves. When we're on the Titanic, we decided women and children first. Well, let's get back to that. Get the children first. Look after the children first of all.
And just finally, we know that some of the trade unions were bellyaching about online teaching because they said it was A, an invasion of a teacher's privacy because it enabled children, or more importantly, I suppose, the parents to peer into the teacher's home. So what? Move into the garden shed, I would say. And other issues were put forward. Did that suggest to you that was the trade unions not exactly busting a gut to get kids back to school? But here we go again, doing what they could. It appeared to me anyway, to disrupt kids getting back to school, a bit of politicking going on.
I think a lot of politicking going on. Look, I am a trade unionist. I sat on the TUC. I was a trade union member for 35 years as a teacher. And is there politicking going on? Absolutely there is. And I was it almost brought tears to my eyes when I heard, of rage, when I heard that a few months ago, one of the union bosses, one of the main unions, was saying that head teachers who opened their schools would be named and shamed. That's mafia style. And as for invasion of privacy, well, we know that on these online platforms such as Zoom, you can change the background anyway. Yeah. That's not an issue at all. And it worries me because the majority of staff in schools are not actually members of a teacher's union. About 48% are, but taking all the support staff as well, majority are not in unions and they're not being consulted. Many teachers will support what I'm saying, but they don't say so because they feel intimidated. And there is beneath the surface quite a bit of intimidation going on. We ourselves at the Campaign for Real Education have had to take material off our website contact details because our own staff have been threatened by the union, by union people. So, you know, we're battling on and we're keeping our site open. But for heaven's sake, the unions need to look ahead and what they should be saying. We need to keep the schools open and also we need to open them during the holidays. They should be open during the Easter and summer holidays.
I agree.
For volunteer teachers.
I agree. We always tend to agree, Chris McGovern. That is Chris McGovern. He is chairman of the Campaign for Real Education. And as ever, thanks so much for joining us. If you enjoy The Daily Show, we hope you do. Why don't you subscribe to us? Even leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, platforms where, of course, you can listen to us. And you can get in touch by emailing us at dailyshow@mailplus.co.uk or follow us at MailPlus. So, man's best friend, his or her dog. How much do you love your dog? How much do you worry that it might be stolen? Well, I don't want to put the fear of God into you, but a lot of them are being pinched. In today's Daily Mail, retired police officer Mike Jasper revealed how he was robbed of his beloved Spaniel Cross Ted by two masked men. We tell other similar stories too. And figures from lost and found organisation Dog Lost show dog napping is on the rise with, get this, thefts rising by 170% in the past year. I'm joined now by Wayne May, who is Senior Police Liaison Officer at Dog Lost. Wayne, these figures are shocking. We call it dog napping, which is sort of almost an affectionate word, but basically dogs are being pinched, possibly to order, and sometimes, presumably, the owners never see the dog again.
That's right, unfortunately. Yeah, they're being stolen more regularly at the moment.
Why do you think that is?
Inadvertently, when we went into lockdown in 2020, on the first lockdown, more people were working from home, spending a lot more time at home with their families, and they was looking for more companion animals. That inadvertently led to a rise of people purchasing dogs and puppies and rehoming dogs from rescue centres. Yeah. And the criminal fraternity capitalised on this, which led to a spark in dog thefts.
So these dogs, when they're pinched, so for instance, Mike Jasper, he was walking through his local park, two men wearing face masks, they pinched his four-year-old, having forced him to the ground. Do you suspect, Wayne, that the two men who stole that dog stole it because somebody wanted that particular breed of dog, or they liked the look of it for themselves and wanted it for themselves?
It's hard to assess individual cases. What we found a lot, especially recently over the last few weeks, is there is a hell of a lot more of aggravated burglaries and aggravated animal thefts cropping up across the whole of the UK. I can't say that they're actually targeting it for a specific breed, but we are getting a lot of people targeted. They're looking for ransom money, especially targeting female dogs to breed from, etc.
Oh, God. So people actually... So sometimes a dog is stolen. Maybe they've worked out that the owner of the dog lives in a smart house or something worth lots of money, Wayne, and then they want money. How much might they want in a ransom, would you say? Or is there an average?
We've been investigating some cases recently with £3,000 to £5,000 ransom.
Good Lord.
But to be honest, I don't think it's where you live or the property you live in. Respectful and, honourable pet owners... your pets are your life, they're absolutely invaluable to you. That's what the thieves are capitalising on.
It's really, really horrible. Do you give advice to people if they get a ransom note or a ransom phone call? If so, what would the advice be?
If you know your dog's stolen, that I'd always go back to your case officer or the police force that's dealing with your case. They are fully equipped to advise you appropriately on how to proceed.
And do the police care, though, Wayne? They've got so much to do, particularly at the moment because of COVID. They're trying to enforce COVID laws, COVID rules, people not breaking social distancing rules, people not going to illegal raves. What do they hear when they get a phone call saying, my dog's been stolen? Isn't that just going to go to the back of the queue?
It doesn't. Unfortunately, I think the police in general across the whole of the UK, they bear the brunt. Obviously, we're dealing with distressed owners. The distressed owners quite often take it out on the police, even though it's not their fault.
Oh, do they really?
That's part of the creation of the Dog Loss Police Liaison Team. We act as an intermediary sometimes between the police and the owners.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite understandable, through the distressing situations that people are going through. What I have found, and, you know, SAMPA, Stolen Missing Pets Alliance, Pet Theft Awareness, what I have found through my own research is it's not down to the police that are at fault. I think the sentencing council at the government end needs to look at this properly. Give the police forces the tools to work with.
Right. Because are you saying to me that if somebody is caught in the act of pinching a dog or you find the dog, if they're prosecuted, they get a small fine or do they get a conditional discharge? Presumably the courts don't have powerful enough sentences to act as a deterrent.
No, they don't, unfortunately. If you get caught with a stolen dog, it's extremely hard to prove that you're the one that actually stole it.
Right.
If you're looking at someone that is actually caught stealing a dog, we're looking at a rough estimate of about £250 fine. So for the criminal fraternity, they know if they get caught, the fines are pathetic. It's the only way to describe it. Unless stiffer penalties are going to come into force, then people are going to continue doing it.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at poor old Mike Jasper, the retired police officer who lost his Spaniel Cross Ted. Some estimates say he paid £600 for Jasper 4 years ago, could sell for up to £3,000 because of the breeding potential.
That's right, yeah. We looked at some averages last year with some different police forces and other organisations. Just for example, a Cocker Spaniel was £800. 2020, we were seeing them sold for £3,000 to
£5,000. Good Lord. What's my cat worth? Nobody's going to pinch my cat, I hope.
So, you know, in a way, it's actually more lucrative than drug dealing. And the penalties are not as harsh.
No. Just finally, Wayne, what's your advice? I guess you should get your pet chipped. That's at the very minimum, is it?
Yeah, always get your dog chipped or any pet microchipped. Make sure that your details with the microchip registry are up to date and current. If you change your phone number, address, one of the first things you should do, like changing your doctor's details, is change it immediately. I would advise owners that, you know, when they go on for walks, just take a different route. Try not to walk alone. Due to this current situation, go with another family member. You say turning left every day, turn right once in a while. Some people keep their dogs in the garden. Up your security, move your kennels closer to your house. Don't keep it at the bottom of the garden. Make sure you've got adequate lighting, etc.
Very, very good advice, and that's very useful advice. That's Wayne May. He's Senior Police Liaison Officer at the Lost and Found organisation Dog Lost. I should have asked you, Wayne, have you got a dog?
Yeah, I've got several. I've got 12 at the moment.
12?
Yeah. So
that's a lot of exercise.
Yeah, I run an independent rescue, and some of them just end up staying.
Aren't you good? Oh, aren't you good? Aren't you good? I hope nobody's tried to pinch any of your dogs.
That's how I actually got involved.
Oh, really?
About 10 years ago, someone ran me over and stole my dogs quite a few years ago. And I was absolutely adamant after that I would make a difference. And Dog Loss was instrumental in me getting some of my dogs back. And it's been my privilege to work with them ever since.
Well, good for you, Wayne. That's a great story. And I'm glad you've got your dirty dozen dogs. Look after them, won't you? That's Wayne May, just to remind you, Senior Police Liaison Officer at Dog Loss. Now, it's time for our regular city update with no better than Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, unemployment. We've got the best unemployment figures in this country since 1973, before the lockdown, and now it's hit 5%. But is it as bad as some had thought it might get to?
No, it's not. So it's very much of a mixed picture here, Andrew. So as you say, before the pandemic struck, we had record low unemployment figures. So the jobless numbers were lower than they'd been since, as you say, since the mid-1970s. And then, of course, the pandemic hit and all of that changed. So we've now got a main unemployment rate of 5%. That's still below where it was a decade ago, actually. But, you know, even so, it's not great. It's going in the wrong direction. But it's a lot less bad than we thought it was going to be in the pandemic. The Bank of England has forecast that unemployment will peak out at 7.75% in the second quarter of this year. Now, actually, we're still at 5%. We're still quite a long way below that. So unless there's a big surge, it might not be as bad as people have anticipated. I think what we also need to bear in mind is that our unemployment is much, much better than it is in the rest of the EU, particularly among young people. Now, unemployment amongst young people has been rising because young people tend to work in the sort of sectors that have been particularly hard hit, you know, things like retail, where we've seen Topshop and Debenhams are going to have big job losses there, and hospitality. So that young people are losing their jobs. But our youth unemployment is nothing like it is in the EU, and that's down to our flexible labour laws, and hopefully now we've had Brexit, that's going to continue and be a source of strength to the UK economy in the future.
Well, that's good news, Ruth. And of course, we're all talking as well about what a relief we're not in the EU because of the row over the rollout of the vaccine. But that's a story for another part of the podcast. That's Ruth Sunderland. She is business editor at the Daily Mail, as ever, on top of the job. So you probably think it could never happen to you, but you know, it could. I'm talking about falling for a scam perpetrated by people pretending to be from HMRC, the tax man, in other words. The latest figures from HMRC show that fake tax emails and calls have risen by almost 75% since the start of the pandemic. Author and journalist Blick Everett nearly fell foul of a £5,000 scam herself, and she was only saved by her very clever and very sceptical son. First thing to say, Flick, he is a clever boy, isn't he? Because he saw straight through it and you didn't.
Yes, I felt such a fool. I was saved by my adult son. I was supposed to be going out for lunch with him and it all happened then. So thank goodness he was there.
So you'd got a phone call from a very plausible sounding man, gave his Christian name, gave a phone number, told you you owed however much it was, slightly shy of a £5,000, and it had to be paid that day, otherwise you would then incur penalty charges. We all know HMRC incurs penalty charges, but I think you'd be the first to admit in hindsight it would be unusual for HMRC to telephone you and say you've got 3 hours to pay.
Oh, absolutely. Normally, I would have been extremely sceptical, but because I was in Manchester and the call was from a Manchester number, it seemed quite likely that because I'd moved several times over the past few years, they may have been sending letters to my previous address because that was something that had happened in the past. So he said, oh, we've been sending you letters, we've been trying to phone you, we've not been able to get hold of you. Now, where I live now in Scotland, I don't really have a Wi-Fi signal. So it did seem feasible to me that they could be calling my mobile and sending letters to my old address, having still got that on their system, and somehow it had been passed to collections, because I know that does happen. So it all piled up to sound feasible enough to make me panic.
And you know, because you say with hindsight, what you should have done was hung up immediately, called the HMRC number, because it is easy to get the phone number, which you could find on your most recent correspondence with HMRC. But you didn't.
Absolutely.
Because this man was so plausible.
He was so plausible. He even put me through to a colleague, in inverted commas, who sounded equally plausible. And also, I think one of the reasons was because they caught me when I was busy. I was rushing through town to meet my son for lunch. Maybe if I'd been sitting at my desk at home, I would have thought twice. But because I was sort of trying to get somewhere and was suddenly stopped in my tracks by this terrifying phone call, I didn't think it through as well as I might have done.
You did what your son advised you. You rang your accountant, sod's law, yeah, if I can use that expression. They were having a training day. How infuriating is that? So no one there to help you. So you were actually getting to the point where you were going to transfer this money to this account that they told you you had to send your money to.
Yes. I mean, in retrospect, obviously it sounds ridiculous that I would go this far with it, but they really did sound so convincing. They gave me a local number to call back, which I thought was the number of the local tax office. You know, they named other colleagues. They explained how much I owed and why. So I believed them. And they gave me this number to call, and they said, oh, we're going to call you in half an hour and you need to have all your details in front of you and we'll talk you through the process.
And then your son, just as you were in the process, mm-hmm, comes charging in the room, don't do it, don't do it, it is a scam. He took the phone from you and confronted this chap who's presumably got the skin of a rhino. You must have a skin of a rhino to carry out a shameless con like
that. I don't think
like
he was
that.
A sensitive type, put it that way.
No. But you actually were worried that your son was being disrespectful.
Yes, you get so sucked in by these people. You know, I'm not some vulnerable older person. You know, I was 49 and I was pretty cynical myself usually and very naturally given to suspicion. I'm a journalist. But because it had all happened the way it did with so little time to think it through and sort of demands upon demands that are terrifying, you know, you've got to get home and you've got to log on and you've got to find your paperwork. And, you know, I didn't think it through properly at all. And because my son took the phone off me and said to him, you know, call yourself Robert Walker or whatever his name was, you know, you're just a scammer. And I was going, no, he isn't. It's real. It's real. My son was looking at me going, Mum, it's not. So thank goodness he saved me from losing $5,000.
And you got through eventually. You talked to the real McCoy, the HMRC, and they made the point, which I know if you go to certain bank cash points, they say we will never ask you to move your money. That we will never. Yeah. So but they know what's going on out there. But he said we would never do this. We would always give you time to pay. Ignore calls that say otherwise. There are a lot of scams, and that must be the advice flick to everyone else who's listening, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I just think always check, because even if it is genuine, it can't do any harm to check. You know, they will understand why you're suspicious. Whereas if you just go along with it because you're frightened, that's what they're hoping you'll do. You know, their whole point is to scare you into doing things quickly and suddenly and panicking. They don't want you to have time to think it through or work out what the flaws might be in their argument. You know, they want to pressurize you into transferring money ASAP, which is what I very nearly did if it weren't for my clever and suspicious son going, hang on a minute, I don't think so.
Maybe you should get him to fill in your tax return as well.
Well, in future, that might not be a bad idea, honestly. It certainly woke me up.
But you're in good company because, as your article makes clear, Flick, in the last 12 months alone, HMRC responded to more than 840,000 referrals of suspicious contact from the public and reported 15,500 malicious web pages to service providers. So while you felt foolish, Flick, you were saved in the end, but also you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's terrifying, the scale of it. You know, even just having shared that article on Twitter this morning, people were getting in touch saying, this happened to me, it happened to my mum, you know, it's happened to me lots of times. It's so, so common now. It's absolutely frightening how sophisticated they are as well. You know, they had it all worked out. There were very few holes in their plan, basically, that you could say, oh, that's obviously suspicious, because it wasn't.
Yeah. And it feeds into all of our paranoia about HMRC. All of our hands tremble when we open a brown envelope from HMRC.
Absolutely.
And we're never quite sure. And I always know if I owe money and they say it has to be paid by X, I'm a fool. I pay it immediately.
Yeah.
Even if I've got three or four or five or even potentially 6 weeks to pay. What if I forget?
Absolutely.
Just pay it.
Yeah.
Because you don't get it. You're not keeping any. There's no interest on your money staying in your account, is there?
Yeah, exactly.
Anymore.
And I think when you're self-employed like me, you know, you're much more scared of getting into trouble as well, because it's just you. There's nobody to back you up if you get into a mess. So having been in a mess in the past years ago with it, I'm naturally very fearful of getting in one again. And as soon as they said it's the collections department, my heart sank and speeded up at the same time. I thought, oh, no, I'm in real
trouble.
At least
you're not on your own. You've got that nice son.
I do.
Great story, Flick. Thank you for sharing it with us in the mail today, because as I say, many, many of our readers will have been through something very similar, yeah. And it's very important advice. That's Flick Everett, who saw off the con men. So we've got time for today for the latest from the Daily Mail. Why don't you download the Mail Plus app? It's very simple. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.